Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. Today, we have another installment of the Triple E's, Education, Empowerment, and Entrepreneurship. Then we have the incomparable Megan Marone, visits with youth from School 12 in Troy.
Afterwards, she'll talk with local artist Kim Tadio.
And later on, we'll get to get another episode of Labor Talks with none other than Willie Terry.
Finally, author Tracy Fish talks with Steve Pierce about peer respite healthcare.
But first, let's start the show off with some rapid headlines.
Major news outlets are reporting that special counsel Robert Mueller has subpoenaed the Trump Organization for documents related to his investigation into whether Trump associates colluded with Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. Mueller's decision to subpoena the company mirrors the strategy he applied to the Trump campaign, which voluntarily gave documents to the special counsel for months before receiving a subpoena in October. The subpoena requests documents and emails from more than a dozen top officials to a set of Russia-related keywords.
According to the Troy Record, struggling dairy farmers would get federal payments to cover production losses under a proposal by the U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat, New York, who described the industry's current financial situation as a national security issue. At present, farms are getting less than $17 per hundredweight for milk, while the cost of production is $23.34. The proposed Dairy Farm Sustainability Act, which Gillibrand wants to see included in the next five-year farm bill, would pay eligible farmers 45% of the difference.
The Time Union reports that for nearly 30 years, the Troy Zoning Board of Appeals has granted zoning variances to project by a 3-2 vote. However, the legal requirement is passage by at least a 4-1 vote. Litigation may be upcoming after the board approved by a 3-2 vote variance, 3-2 vote a variance to convert a closed church building into an apartment house, despite strong opposition from Hillside residents. It looks like it would be the developers that would have to sue, since the city administration now agrees with the need for 4 votes. However, the 4-vote requirement appears to be left over from a time when the board had 6 members.
Hundreds of students from Cahoes High School walked around school for 17 minutes Wednesday morning to remember the 17 victims who were killed last month at Florida High School. Students from the high school took part in a nationwide school walkout Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to call for gun law changes and remember the recent school shooting victims. Other area schools participating include Albany High, Niskayuna, Shaker High, and Boston Spa. In Schuylerville, they got detention. In South Glens Falls, they got homework.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The issue of plastic bags has been a hot topic at the state capitol this year after the governor and legislature last year blocked an NYC law on plastic bags from taking effect. WOOC talked with Samantha McVeigh of the New York Public Interest Research Group about the latest update on the effort to ban plastic bags in New York.
We're talking with Samantha McVeigh, who is a policy associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group. NYPIRG recently released a letter from almost 200 organizations calling upon Governor Cuomo to introduce legislation for a statewide ban on plastic bags. Samantha, what prompted NYPIRG to circulate this letter?
So we actually circulated that letter for many reasons. One of them being, you know, the governor last year made a promise to New Yorkers that he would include a plastic bag ban for statewide legislation, but then didn't. So NYPIRG decided, you know, we really need to contact our community and urge our legislators to get involved.
Now, what is the problems with plastic bags?
Thanks for asking. There's several problems with plastic bags. One of them is that they're environmentally unstable. They don't break down in water. Animals consume them frequently and cause lots of damage. And the toxic chemicals that are in plastic bags bioaccumulate up the chain to humans. And also, they're very damaging on the environment that we see in our parks and our trees, and even to our sanitation departments. New York City paid $12.5 million last year to fix plastic bag-related problems with their machinery. So it's not good for anybody.
Now, I understand that in the last couple of years, New York City had passed legislation to restrict the use of plastic bags, I believe with some type of fee on plastic bags. What happened to that bill?
So you're right. That bill did exist. It did charge 5 cents for plastic bags that are single-use bags. The governor repealed that. That's what I was talking about earlier. He repealed it and said, you know, we need a statewide solution, not just a city solution. But we have not yet seen it. He did release a plastic bag report in early January with somewhere around 8 solutions for a statewide, but then never actually decided on one to use.
So are there other communities either in New York or across the country that have enacted some type of restrictions on plastic bags? And if so, what do they tend to be?
Awesome. So that's actually really exciting. California has a ban and fee statewide. They've had that since last year. And because of that, they've seen half of the amount of plastic bags on their beaches that they saw in 2010. In New York, there's 14 municipalities total that have plastic bag bans, and one of them is Suffolk County and New Paltz. We're really excited to see that. That means that it's happening and we're getting somewhere.
Now, last year, of course, both the Senate and the Assembly passed legislation to block the New York City law from going into effect. That law the governor, you know, then signed. What, if anything, have we heard from state legislative leaders about their thoughts of dealing with plastic bags?
So we've heard several comments and kind of all across the field. You get as far, you know, left of the issue with Flanagan saying, you know, he's very against it. You get in the middle where Liz Krueger and Steve Englebright are working on a bill that has since been proposed to the floor to be considered to ban and have a fee on plastic bags. And then you get to the right of the issue where Senator Selmsha Felder said, you know, that they're not encouraging a statewide ban and fee until we work more on our recycling legislation that really hasn't been enforced. So you kind of have responses all across the board, but we're really excited that people are engaged in the issue.
Now, you mentioned that the governor had put a task force together and they had issued a report which included some ideas, but the governor himself has not, the report did not make an actual proposal for state action. What has the governor's reaction in the last, week or two been in terms of moving ahead with plastic bags?
Well, that's the most exciting part of all. In the last week or so, the governor came out and said, you know, I believe that it's time that we do something about plastic bags because they're so harmful for the environment, and said he would be very supportive of a statewide solution. He would sign one. But what that looks like is yet to be seen.
Now, one of the arguments made against the plastic bag system in New York City, which was a fee on plastic bags at retail outlets, so it did exempt those purchased with WIC or food stamps, was that it would have a negative impact, regressive impact upon low-income people. What's your response that, you know, trying to restrict use of plastic bags discriminates or harms economically low-income people?
So that's a thing that we really have to talk about. That idea exists. And even myself, when I started working this issue, I had that concern. And that's something that is just being perpetuated that isn't true. It is a myth. There is no evidence that supports the claim that a plastic bag fee and ban would hurt or harm low-income communities. And we know and have seen in California statewide that people of all communities are adjusting well to this ban and fee. It just means a few small lifestyle changes. But the best news for everyone is that removes the burden from all communities from having to think about recycling, from having to deal with the, you know, the larger costs to all of us that we take on with plastic bags. So if anything, it's helping low-income communities.
if any of our listeners out there are, you know, interested in trying to deal with the plastic bag issue, you know, what can they do at this point?
So the best thing to do is to urge your local legislators to get on board with a plastic bag ban and fee. Again, that and there is really important. You need both. They can sign on to our letter that I think is on our website. I'm not sure. I can get that information to you. They, again, should just be contacting their local legislators as much as possible and getting involved. You know, make sure you're not littering. Try to go and reuse your own bags as much as possible. While the burden shouldn't be on you, it right now is, but it's in all of our hands to make a change.
Well, some people say that getting rid of plastic bags would also help the issue of climate change. What's the role of climate change with plastic bags?
So great question. I don't have facts about this for certain, and I can, again, get back to you on this, but, you know, plastic bag facilities and paper bag facilities require resources, and it is a production environment. It is a factory environment, which means that when you're creating this many plastic bags, which, for example, the world uses 5 trillion plastic bags in a year, that's 160,000 per second. So that's not good for the environment. And, you know, for those of us who like to eat fish or those of us who like to swim in the water, poisoning our water with chemicals like BPA and carcinogens is just not good. So for the climate change debate, it is a no-go.
And so we've been talking with Samantha McVay, who is the policy associate of the New York Public Interest Research Group.
That was WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley providing us with an update on the effort to ban statewide plastic bags.
Each Thursday, we have been featuring the voices of youth from the Capital Region. This week, WOOC correspondent, the incomparable Megan Marone, sat down with the students and teachers from Troy's ALP School 12 to ask them the difference between fitting in and belonging to a community.
In your mind, what is the difference between fitting in and belonging?
Family?
Belonging is feeling you're very comfortable and you don't need to hide anything. Fitting in just means you're fitting into a mold similar to the people around you. Belonging means you're very comfortable.
Cookie, what do you think?
Fitting in is you really don't even want to be their friend, really. It's just like they have more popular, you want to be more popular, so you want to hang out with them. And belonging is like, that's your actual friends, like you feel more comfortable and free around them.
Yeah, and Kayla, you were talking about people being there for each other through thick and thin. So what are your ideas about the difference between fitting in and belonging?
Fitting in is where you're not really a part of the group. And belonging is where you can be yourself around them no matter who they are, as long as you're like close to them or whatever.
What do you think is the difference between fitting in and belonging?
With Miss Judith said, I think belonging, you feel a part of something, whereas fitting in, it might not be your style or who you are, but you're doing the things that you think will get you to gain the people around you. It might not be something you agree with, but you do it anyway so that you can fit in with that population instead of being yourself and feeling more comfortable in your own skin, belonging to your own category, belonging to your own individualized group.
Do you think that it is important to know the difference and to be able to go through life discerning the difference between fitting in and when you actually are accepted and when you feel like there's reciprocity and you love people and they love you and there's this comfort? Do you think that that's an important skill to build?
Yes, because you don't want to be like getting, I don't know.
You don't want to be hanging out with the wrong people.
People, yeah, and they might be like not treating you the same way that the people that you feel like you belong to treat you.
Actually, your body responds in different situations where you physically feel different. I think it was either Kaylee or Cookie brought up the first day of school as being like a bit. Oh, that was Jamisa. Sorry. So as a big fitting in test day. So what are some of the ways that you feel when you feel like you're just trying to fit in?
Nervous. Anxious.
You get butterflies in your stomach.
Because you don't want to say the wrong thing. And they don't like you.
When I have new friends on the first day of school, yeah.
When I feel like I'm in a situation where there's some sort of test or evaluation, your muscles get tighter, whereas you just physically, your muscles go limp like rubber bands when you're with people who you feel comfortable with.
I feel the same way. I feel like if it's your first day, you have to look a certain way, maybe have your hair different, be more presentable, more conscious of what you're going to say, what you're going to do. because you, like Cookie said, you don't want to say the wrong thing that might offend anybody, and you don't want to be looked at as this person that is offensive. So you kind of just want to sit back, watch, and wait to see what else happens. So anxious, nervous, all those feelings the girls said, trying to look more appealing to people.
A lot of people would say that schools should be fostering more community and more of that feeling of actual belonging. Do you think that that is the job of schools or not really? That, you know, the social stuff and family stuff happens outside of school?
I kind of think both at the same time because, you know, you should be able to, you know, talk to certain teachers or students about certain stuff, but everything doesn't have to be, you know, brought to school.
Well, thank you. Do you have any final comments or wishes for young people out there, people younger than you who are going through maybe hard times with fitting in versus belonging? Do you have any advice?
Everybody is not your friend, okay?
Just be your normal self. Don't try to act, you know, different, because people, if they should like you for you, not you acting like somebody else.
Yes. Cool. Well, thank you to Judith, Mariah, Cookie, Kaylee, and Jamisa.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk That was Cookie, Kaylee, and Jamisa, 8th graders at Troy's ALP School 12, and Judith and Mariah, teachers at Troy's School 12, speaking about why the formation of authentic community is messy and important. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine every Thursday to hear the voices and perspectives of youth from the Capital Region.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Our next segment is, each Thursday, we have been featuring, each Thursday we have been featuring the voices of local artists, dancers, and poets. Today, we look at how poetry informs visual arts by speaking with Kim Tadio, a painter who moved from New York City to Troy last year. Kim sat down for a dialogue about poetry with WOOC correspondent, once again, the incomparable Megan Marone.
You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
That was Kim Tadio reading Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. What role has poetry played in your life?
Poetry has been something that I feel like I've just found in different ways. People have sent me poems, or when I was working in an office job, you'd be scrolling on Tumblr and finding pretty poems and pretty words and imagery, and as kind of a little escape from the office job. That poem in particular, I remember listening to the first time after doing a grueling yoga class, being exhausted and then hearing that and, you know, then hearing the singing bowl, and you're not sure if you're passing out or if it's a singing bowl, and those words still kind of swimming in your head. So it's a nice way to hear breaking up of a sentence and slowing things down.
I love how that poem is about belonging too, and her asserting not only her own belonging to the world, but the belonging of everything and everyone within the world.
Yes, I also love that. And just also just belonging, just that you belong here and that you can just sit into the moment, which is maybe why the yoga teacher read it. We're exhausted, you've worked really hard, and now let's just listen and lay and just be in the Savasana pose and just take it all in and know that you are belonging in this moment and with everyone in this space. I haven't done yoga in a long time, so it's been a long time, but still it stuck with me.
Now, are you the type of person where you started reading poetry when you were a kid?
I was. I liked poetry when I was a kid. I mean, probably like in high school is when I was introduced to poetry and haikus, short little things of how to express yourself in these metaphorical ways. I mean, actually, there was a class in college I completely forgot about until just this moment when I was, when we did a book of poems, and I really enjoyed, because I'm a visual artist, I liked, and I keep saying this
again, but taking a sentence and breaking it up and manipulating it in space. Literally, not all the words have to be in one line, but they can be moving vertically instead of all horizontally.
I was thinking about your visual art, and if anybody wants to see Kim's art, there's a show going on right now at Carmen's in South Troy, and I wonder if it's comparable to say that when you are painting, especially in abstraction, which your paintings have both identifiable elements in them, and then there's this definite abstraction, and going into the world describing a setting in the most rote way that you could, going into a classroom and saying there's a desk here and a chair, versus the poet's vision, being able to translate the energy of how the space feels, or the more spiritual or metaphorical utility of the objects and people within that space. So do you see a correlation in that way?
When I'm visually painting, my paintings are a lot about my feelings and just moving through my feelings. I probably start off writing poetry or just brain dumping into a journal, and maybe they come off poetic, maybe not. And then I go into my visual painting and I've moved through it. So yes, there can be moments that are longer and then shorter brush strokes, and it's all really layered on top of each other. In a painting, and like layering my feelings, it's a way of being able to be with all of it, almost in that belonging way of that poem.
Have you ever encountered, because you have been involved in certain justice movements and you're concerned with the environment, have you ever encountered poetry in justice movements?
One of the first times I came to Troy, like I think I was at a poly party, Amani was doing poetry, and it was amazing. I mean, I don't even know that I could describe the experience except for I was blown away. That was my most memorable experience of a social justice poetic movement. And I know that there are a lot of other poets out there, but hearing Amani really blew me away that night. But I know you are also a poet. Could you maybe tell me about your experience with that? I don't know. It's fun to hear about you.
Yeah, well, I love Allen Ginsberg.
Would you like to read something of his?
Sure. This is Poem Rocket from his book, Kaddish and Other Poems. This is my rocket, my personal rocket. I send up my message beyond, someone to hear me there. I send up my rocket to land on whatever planet awaits it, preferably religious sweet planets with no money, fourth-dimensional planets where death shows movies. Plants speak courteously of ancient physics, and poetry itself is manufactured by the trees. The final planet, where the great brain of the universe sits waiting for a poem to land in his golden pocket, joining all the other notes, mash notes, love sighs, complaints, musical shrieks of despair, and the millions of unutterable thoughts of frogs. I send you my rocket of amazing chemical, more than my hair, my sperm, or the cells of my body. The speeding thought that flies upward with my desire, as instantaneous as the universe and faster than light.
That was really amazing.
Yeah, it's part of Kaddish. Kaddish is the Jewish death prayer. So the first part of that book deals with the death of his mother, Naomi. He was from Paterson, New Jersey, which actually has amazing gorges. People think of the gorges out in Ithaca, but there are all of these amazing deep ravines. And his mother was an English teacher. That particular poem was written on the eve of the Sputnik being launched. So humanity was in space for the first time. He was thinking about all of the ways that things could be different in space. I feel like it's a super exciting poem.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's like an adventure poem. Thanks for letting me ask you some questions. We can have more conversations about poems another time.
That was local painter Kim Tadio speaking with a member of the WOOC family, Megan Marone. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine for more information about local dance, poetry, and music events. The Hill County Observer is a long-running bi-monthly newspaper serving the rural areas of eastern New York, southwestern Vermont, and northwestern Massachusetts. The cover of the February-March issue features a story about small peer respite houses where people in crisis can stay as an alternative to hospitalization. WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce spoke with the author, Tracy Frisch.
There's been a movement since the 70s of people who have had encounters with the psychiatric system, it's basically been an anti-oppression liberation type movement, and out of that movement developed the concept of peer support, where people support one another. Don't say, "Oh, you have anxiety or you have some emotional issues. You should just go see a professional," but where people respectfully listen and share their own experiences with one another. And that has changed many people's lives. Often when you're feeling down or feeling out of control, it's easy to think you are the only one and that there's no one in the world who can possibly understand what you're going through. I think many of us have had times in our lives when we feel, you know, we feel different or alienated. So one of the many, there's many interesting and supportive things that have come out of what has been called the peer movement, or the psychiatric survivor movement, or different things. So there's different names. One of them is the idea of a place to go in crisis that is run by and staffed by people who have lived experience with emotional distress, with trauma, often with psychiatric encounters. And so there's, I think about 5 years ago, there were only around a dozen in the country of these places called peer respites. People can usually go there for a week. They're usually free, and there's no use of force or coercion. There's no social workers or psychiatrists or other representatives of the mental health system there. It's a safe space, a sanctuary from the kind that those systems, and also from everyday life when people need a break. So this article I wrote was about three particular peer respites, one in Western Mass in the city of Northampton that serves all the way to the Berkshires and into the counties in the Pioneer Valley. Another one is in Rochester, Vermont, about an hour or so north of Rutland. That is the only peer respite in Vermont, and people come from all counties in the state. And then there's one in the city of Glens Falls, which is a little more mainstream. So people call up. They can't be placed in these settings. They have to desire to go and take some initiative. So that in itself is very different from ending up in an emergency department and a psychiatric ward. Many people are brought by the police or ambulances or other emergency services, often against their will, into the hospital setting. But in these peer respites, people come. They can sleep if they've been staying up all night, if that's what they want to do. They could, you know, talk. They can talk with people who have had similar difficult experiences, where there will be understanding. And I think the most important point is no judgment, you know, and not the expectation that if you have this kind of, if you have extreme emotional state, or you're hearing voices that are telling you that you're no good or whatever, that you will have no potential to have a good life and a good quality of life, or to contribute to society. The understanding is that people go through things, and sometimes by going through things, it's possible to get out the other side with more self-knowledge and more ability to live the life that you desire. So that's actually very radical thinking in our society.
So your article is available online at hillcountryobserver.com. But if people want information on how to find these peer respite facilities, where would they go?
Well, let's see. I think probably looking up peer respite Glens Falls, you would probably find it. But that particular facility is called Rose House, like the flower. And there's actually three others in the lower, mid and lower Hudson Valley, all run by one organization. The one in Vermont, which is open to any Vermont resident, after you talk to the staff, and is called Alyssum, like the flower, A-L-Y-S-S-U-M. The one in Northampton, Mass, which is available to people from Berkshire County east, up to Springfield, is called AFIA, A-F-I-Y-A, which is a Swahili word meaning something like physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being, which is a beautiful idea. And there's, if you have friends or relatives in other parts of the country, you could probably find, there's several directories online looking for peer respites.
So this sounds in many ways different from the medicalized care for these kinds of issues. But maybe most prominently that if somebody's in crisis and is sent somewhere by somebody else, that requires no pre-planning. You call the emergency number and they come and cart them away. In this case, do you need to plan ahead a little bit more, or can you be...
Well, some of these places have waiting lists, and you call, and I know AFIA, they have their house manager said they have five times as many people interested in coming as they have room for, but they'll keep a short waiting list. And if you are not on the waiting list yet because the waiting list is kept short, if you still want to come, you just call up repeatedly, which can be frustrating, especially when you're in crisis. They tend to be small and have two or three bedrooms only. You have your own bedroom. We live in a society that does not put enough resources into alternatives, even into the mainstream, but certainly the alternatives are very meagerly funded, even though they have demonstrated that they save a lot of money. Stay in a psychiatric facility is hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day, and these are the costs are much more modest. These tend to be a house that's been renovated for that feels like home, and just has been renovated to meet fire codes or whatever else they would need to meet as a licensed facility. But I think one of the most important differences is really the use of force, and many people who end up in a psychiatric ward or hospital have been put in seclusion, where there's basically like a mattress on the floor, and you're locked in because you're too like loud or they think you're violent or something like that. But the whole situation could make anyone pretty angry, especially when you are being taken away without consent. Another thing, people are unbelievably put in restraints where they're strapped down to beds, sometimes for many hours at a time.
Well, we're running out of time, but I think that one of the most interesting aspects of your article is that it references the state of the art for a movement that's been underway for many decades. So if folks are listening and some of this sounds interesting and important to them, maybe resonates in their own lives or with people who they know, where can they get in touch with a movement? Not so much the Peer Respite Network, but the movement for changing medical...
Right, for medicating emotions, basically.
Yes.
I think the best organization in our region is called the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. That's a long name, but what you have to remember is Western Mass, and then the three letters RLC, Recovery Learning Community. They have a great website. You can watch videos on the website. You could read newsletters and hear about a lot of interesting and important events, and you can connect. It's a little bit out of our region, but you could take workshops that are life-changing there. So Western Mass RLC.
That was Tracy Frisch speaking about her Country Observer cover story on peer respite houses, where people in crisis can stay as an alternative to hospitalization. You can find the article online at hillcountryobserver.com. For those just tuning in, I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at themediasanctuary.org. H. Bosch Jr., myself, all right, WOOC correspondent, Triple E segment, and Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship, sat down with the Honorable Cheryl Cates Benin, attorney, magazine editor, runway model, to talk about her and her stellar career and being an entrepreneur. This is H. Bosch Jr. with the Triple E segment of the program, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest, Cheryl Cates.
I'm Cheryl Cates Benman. I am a defense attorney practicing in matters of parole and corrections. I'm also the editor of Rochester Woman Online magazine. I'm a print and runway model, and I am consulting with a lot of artists. I'm here this weekend for a show with Limitless Records.
How does hip-hop play in all of this?
So hip-hop plays in this because I've always merged my career with things that I love. So I actually was a former radio show host myself with my own show that was called Law and Hip-Hop.
On, yes, your show.
And I also work as a consultant, and I help a lot of artists that are seeking careers with rap or other types of music.
Okay. So what do you do at Rochester Online?
Rochester Women Online.
Yeah, so, Women Online.
Yes.
Right.
So I am the editor. We are an online publication. We also do quarterly events, which are women's expos, and I function as the runway coordinator and creative design person at some of our photo shoots, and I'm also an in-print ad and runway model.
Okay. Now, this is where you've made your legend.
Yeah.
Your legacy. You are a legend in this field.
Thank you.
What is wrong with the New York State criminal justice system?
Oh, boy. So
please tell us, Ms. Cates.
I will. So we have several issues right now with the criminal justice system, which we are making great headway from when I started as a defense attorney 15 years ago, which I also started. I was here, as I explained to you. I was actually sitting at a table here, which I believe Allison Coleman was present, and I think Judith Brink as well. So okay. I started my career here, so it was really cool to come back to this Sanctuary for Independent Media because the meeting was here that we actually started working on the reform movement of what we were going to do with parole, which we're making headway now with parole. But I've also switched gears where I'm kind of working with people that are innocent, that are convicted, because there's no provision for this in the parole law. Mm-hmm. So I've started talking to Marty Tankliff, Jeffrey, about these different things.
Yeah, and all legends in the
yes.
field, especially Jeff.
Yes.
And a good friend.
Yeah. What is interesting is, yes, we need the prosecutorial reform that you guys are working on, but there's also an issue with parole that it used to be if you maintained your innocence, you would automatically be hit at the parole board. I've been able, a lot of my clients that were inside with innocence claims, they're now free. So I've been working on trying to push that we can add that to our platform once we get what we need with the prosecutorial misconduct. I think that we need to start pushing for another provision in the parole law to include the mitigational factor of a claim of actual innocence, which right now we do not have that.
So looking back 15 years as a defense attorney, is there such a thing as criminal justice?
That's a rough question. yes and no. When I walked out of law school, I went to SU, so Syracuse University of Law. I came out with the thought that I was going to change the world. And then
didn't we all?
Reality comes in like, yeah,
boo. Bites you in the behind, right?
Yeah. So when I came out, it was very difficult for me in law school 15 years ago because the school was geared towards corporate attorneys and intellectual property type things. There was not very many things for us. They wanted to go into criminal defense unless you were interested in being in the clinic. So I served as the president of the Civil Liberties Union in the college and then later ended up stepping up as the interim director at our local office in Syracuse because their director left. So I actually jump started into it on a civil liberties level, which for me was challenging because they want to do First Amendment issues, freedom of speech, this and that. So I kind of stepped up and brought prison issues to the table before they were doing that. So I actually went in feet first. I started working with Planned Parenthood and we were talking.
This is my new producer, by the way.
we were working with pregnant women in custody being forced to give birth in shackles. So I worked with Planned Parenthood first. Then we started working with doing other things and trying to make a difference because no one wanted to care about prison issues. So one of the cases, which this is kind of crazy, but we had a young man that was writing our office because he was being disciplined in the county jail in Onondaga County for doing things that guys do in the jail cell by themselves. And a female guard saw him and then wrote a disciplinary ticket. So I became an advocate for that. And they were making fun of me like, oh, we're going to represent the wanker. And I was like, no, it's a different issue. He has a right. It's his own body.
Right.
If he's not doing it to sexually harass the guard, then what's wrong with that? And that started to open their eyes that maybe I was onto something. And then I did a lot of work with the healthcare in Onondaga County Jail. So I worked with the Human Rights Division trying to oversee their medical because of my medical background. Okay, so I did a lot. Yeah,
let me get into this because we have short on time, but there's some more stuff I definitely want to touch on.
Right.
You are so accomplished.
Thank you.
I got to ask you this. Give me your highlights in your career as an attorney.
Okay.
Give me one or two real big ones. I know you have so many.
The biggest thing that made an impact for me was right when I began becoming an attorney, and I was working with the lifers in an Auburn correctional facility, and this case came up, which actually was featured in a post that I just made about sadistic guards in Auburn Correctional Facility. So I was working with this client, Dino Caricelli, and he's actually featured in this newspaper article. He's the inmate that is bloodied face in the articles. So there was a group of guards there that was known as the Black Glove Crew. So I was working along, and Tom Tetrazzini from PLS at the time, he had just ventured out into his own practice, and we were actually able to get the FBI to come in and start investigating them, and most of those guards were taken out of Auburn at the time, but this lieutenant stayed, and there was a second one that was promoted. So this lieutenant is actually now in the news because he was using Guantanamo Bay-type punishments to inmates in Auburn where he beat someone with a baton in their genital area and was, like, dumping water on people's faces. So it was very, for me, to see that this week, that it took 15 years to get justice, and Dino was beaten beyond his bones all over broken.
Wow.
And we were actually protesting on Main Street. The cops made us move from in front of the court building because they charged him with assaulting a guard for trying to defend himself.
Wow.
And we were forced to move to the corner. And it was on the main street in Auburn, which the prison sits there. And the bus pulled out from the jail. And it was filled with inmates being taken upstate to other prisons.
Wow.
And I stood there. I was being interviewed. I was there with them. Barry Juwanter from the New York Civil Liberties Union. And the press was all there filming us. We were protesting. We had signs. And the inmates were all on the bus. And I didn't have anything on identifying myself. And they all started screaming out of the window of the bus, we love you, Mrs. Cates.
Great. So let me ask you three words. Journalist, promoter, model.
Yeah. Right? That's my other side jobs.
Right, right. Yeah. And those are all things that you do and that you have brought skills to. And you what I call an outstanding entrepreneur. I mean,
Thank
your
you.
Story and what you have accomplished. So I'm going to ask you real quick before we close out. What's next?
What's next? I don't know. I was promoting and was stuck in Rochester. Myself and Mary, we worked at Taylor's Nightclub, and we promoted for about a year there. And now that club is no longer there. So we're getting ready to figure out what we're doing next, which our business partner, Joby King, was unexpectedly found dead at 37 years old the day before Thanksgiving. Geez. So we're kind of so thank you. Sorry. We're trying to regroup. So it's been a rough couple months. So I don't know yet. We're still figuring it out.
Well, I want to say, Miss Cates, thank you. You know, this was a long time coming. You are my sister from another mister. I am blessed, honored, and truly humbled to have you as a guest on the show. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to bless us with this interview, as well as our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are so welcome. Until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. That was my interview with Miss Cates. Thanks again, Cheryl, and continued blessings to whatever you do in the future. We wish you all the best.
In this week's episode of Labor Talk, Willie Terry sat down with Candace to talk about Women's History Month and her work as a labor organizer.
Yeah, good evening. Talking about revolution. This is Labor Talk, and my name is Willie Terry. Today we will continue the Labor Talk discussion theme around Women's History Month. Today we will be speaking with Candace Leiter. Candace is a longtime labor activist, and she's also a secretary of the Troy Area Labor Council. Hello, Candace.
Hello.
All right. Happy Women's History Month.
Thank you.
All right. Let me get started by asking you to tell us something, a little something about yourself.
Okay. Well, I've been with the Troy Area Labor Council for over 20 years, and I've acted as their secretary for more 20-plus years, I've been, before that, I still am a delegate to NYSET and a delegate to the AFL-CIO.
What's
New York State United Teachers. I'm a speech-language pathologist, so my union is New York State United Teachers.
Okay. Prompted you to get involved in the labor movement? Because I know you're a longtime activist. So how did you get started?
Well, prior to my employment at BOCES, I was worked in an ARC up in Gloversville, and they didn't have a union. And I saw a lot of not so nice things happen up there. They would promote people who weren't really qualified, and they would fire people who were very qualified, based on their relationship with management. And so that was the first seed, you know, that said, wow, this isn't a good situation for workers. So when I joined, when I started working for BOCES, thereafter I said, I'm definitely going to join the union, and I'm definitely going to go to the union. I met a wonderful friend and a long-term friend. You've met her, too. You went down to Woodstock. My friend Ann Frazier, and she was the one who really put the activist spirit in me. She's very much a radical, and I loved her. And she really got me on the road to where I am now.
Right. Yep.
I appreciate her. And I got to mention one other person, my Aunt Rosemary, who is a longtime activist, feminist, and part of Veterans for Peace nationally.
So that's interesting. You know, people have, family activists bring other families into the activist thing.
Yeah.
That was good. Yeah, and so, I did go to Woodstock.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Woodstock that I've seen on television, but it was more progressive.
You know Odell, right?
I know you said you were the teacher, but I just want to ask you something about the West Virginia Teachers Strike. What do you think of that?
Oh, I'm totally inspired by the West Virginia Teachers Strike. It really raised my spirits, because not only did they get a 5% raise for themselves, but in solidarity with all public employees, they raised all of their incomes by 5%. So that was great. I'm also happy that it showed that they live in a right-to-work state. So even though they lived in a right-to-work state and they had a very, very weak union, they were able to still strike, and they were all on the same page. They had community support for their strike, and it gives me hope in this Supreme Court decision, the Janus decision, where they're going to withdraw fair share and agency fees as part of union. You know, if you're in a union shop, whether you're in the union or not, you have to pay those fees. And this Supreme Court decision will take that away, and it looks like it will weaken unions. But here's a good example of the union not being weak and being bold.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, you're Secretary of the Troy Labor Council, you know.
Yes.
So what are some of your responsibilities?
Well, some of my responsibilities at the Troy Area Labor Council would be, I have to attend the meetings, and then I write the monthly minutes. But in addition to that, over the years, I've written editorials as a ghostwriter. I've written speeches. I've done other things like, I've participated in picket lines, which were marvelous, and I've met fantastic people. Some of my best friends I've met some of my best friends in the labor movement, and it's connected me with other movements like the environmental movement. Troy Area Labor Council is very active in the Hudson River cleanup, and that segued into, I was on the board of directors of CEC for a while, which is Citizens Environmental Coalition, and that since has gone under. But, it's just, and Solidarity, which are a great group of people, and just all of these wonderful people I've met, like yourself, it makes you feel like you're really doing something to change instead of just getting frustrated by what's happening in the world.
Yeah, I am involved in it. And right, it's an active, one of the activist labor councils I ever seen. And, you being the secretary, all active person, too. Now, I know this is Women's History Month.
And, yes.
What are some of the concerns and issues, of women's in the labor movement?
Well, I would say, this goes back to the West Virginia teachers and all teachers. Do you know that 70% of teachers are women? Mm-hmm. And we receive some of the lowest pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, West Virginia was one of the lowest paid group in the whole country. And our pay is not commensurate with men's. Mm-hmm. So a man with the equivalent education would probably make, I make 80% of what a man would make with the equivalent education that I have. And not I personally, but women in general. And that goes down. And when you're talking about minorities, so African-American woman would make 60%. And when you're talking about Hispanic women, they make even less than that. So that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Not only are we not being paid, we're considered, we're put in less powerful and influential situations, And that's what made that West Virginia strike even more powerful for women, too.
Well, they also had a series of women protests, over the past year or so in Washington, and then they have, a women's movement.
Oh, the Women's March in Albany.
Right.
I went to that.
Down?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's extremely important because, it's important for many reasons because we're relevant in the, without us. I mean, I think they had a few demonstrations in Spain and so on. Spain was a big one where the women actually didn't go to work on Women's Day. And, they shut down the country because they, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So how do women become members of the Labor Council, or how do one become a member?
Oh, how does a woman become? It's pretty much the same for everybody, men and women.
Okay.
You go to your local union and say, I'd like to be a delegate to the Troy Area Labor Council or Albany Labor Council, whatever labor council you're affiliated with. And then they can either say yes, or if somebody's already there, you can run for office.
And they have labor councils in different areas? Do they have one in Albany?
Albany, all over the state. They have different labor councils, sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, We only have a short time left, but I just want to know if there's anything you would like to say about the Troy Labor Council or Women History Month, anything you'd like to
say? Oh, sure. There's lots I'd like to say. I just want to say that women are relevant, and I hope that there's more listening instead of talking at women, and that would be a very good thing. I also want to say, give a shout-out to my female union members as well as my male. I love them too, but since it's women's history, I gotta give a shout out to Susan Du Bois, who's a bit longtime union activist and a very good friend of mine, Fran Hyde, who's been in the Troy Area Labor Council for a long, long time, Susan Haynes, Pat Fundy, who's a special person, and all the rest, and especially to my deceased friend, Candy Ansel, who gave a lot, who has always had my back in the union. She's a very, very supportive person.
Okay.
Right. And I'd like to just end with this quote for union activism. Yeah. It's a great quote. It's by Dolores Huerta. And
Is that the one the film was about?
It's gone. Yes, and it's she was co-founder of the National Farm Workers Association, and she was a worker, immigrant, and women's rights advocate. And this is her quote, and I think it's excellent. It says, "Every moment is an organizing opportunity. Every person a potential activist. Every minute a chance to change the world." And I feel so much like that. I think that a union is not one person. It's a bunch of people all getting together for the common good.
Right. All right, Candy.
Okay.
Thanks, Candy. And
thanks,
I want to thank
Tony.
You for coming in for this interview, doing this interview with the Labor Talk program. And I know you have many more things you can share with us. I know you got a lot. You're a longtime activist. And I hope you will come back in the future to share more of your labor knowledge with us. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Thank you, Willie. It's been great talking to you.
No problem. This has been Labor Talk. I'm your host, Willie Terry. Until next time, do as Public Enemy said, fight the power that be.
That was Willie Terry's Labor Talk, featuring labor organizer Candace. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm H. Bosch, Jr. Remember to tune back into tomorrow and every Wednesday at 7 a.m. or every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook.
Have a beautiful evening. Oh, as a reminder, WOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7.07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.